Professor Chacolone, Professor Bon Jovi, Professor Ryder, my friends. It's a real pleasure to be here today. I read Henry George in graduate school. He was not on the assigned list. And I have to confess that if I had gone down an academic path at that time, I would not have had the courage to follow the remorseless logic of the Georgist position. But I didn't do that, so I wasn't faced with this particular ethical choice. Instead, I went to work for what is sometimes referred to as the government. It's actually the United States Congress, where I found myself on the staff of the Banking Committee, new chairman, who had just renamed it the Committee on Banking, Finance, and Urban Affairs. The chairman's name was Henry Royce. He was a congressman from Milwaukee. And it turned out that his wife, Margaret Royce, was a committed Georgist, an economist who on the faculty of the University of the District of Columbia. So that influence was in the background of many of our conversations in those years, many years ago. My career and my interests eventually took me in other directions, resistance to the economics of the administration of Ronald Reagan at the time, monetarism, what became known as neoliberalism, issues of war and peace and conflict resolution, and then in recent years, the work that Joe Chacolone mentioned on the measurement of inequality both inside the United States and at the world scale. But it was only in the middle 1990s that I came back into contact with the Henry George tradition. And that was as a result of, by a series of strange serendipities, becoming in 1993 the exorbitantly titled Chief Technical Advisor to the State Planning Commission of the People's Republic of China for macroeconomic reform. The actual duties being much less grand than the title, but the title is nice. You can put it on your resume. And it was there, working with officials in the Chinese government, that the force of George's influence in the world kind of hit home to me, which lay in the discovery that the economic power of the city and the province in China lay in their control of ground rent, their ownership of the land, which meant that governments have, particularly at the local level, fountains of revenue which they can and do reinvest in physical improvements without the need to have a burden or an administrative structure to collect the sales taxes, the income taxes, or the property taxes for that matter, that form the substructure of municipal and regional government in the United States. And you know, this is a striking fact. You go to Shanghai and you realize that New York is practically a provincial town by comparison these days, and you wonder, how is it? Where did the money come from that funded that? And the answer is, of course, it does come from the collection of rent. And a Chinese colleague at a conference sometime along the way pointed out that the most influential, made the argument that the most influential economist in modern China today was not by a long shot Karl Marx, but rather Henry George. And not just by happenstance, but because the founder of modern China, Sun Yat-sen, was a follower of Henry George. So you might say that I have been ever since something of an advocate of communist revolution, the dispossession of landlords, the ownership of land by the state, provided, of course, that the revolution is something which is sufficiently far in the past that you don't have to actually live through it. At a karaoke bar in Beijing sometime in the 1990s, a Chinese colleague made the remark that I was possibly the only communist left in China. A remark which would had an element of truth to it, not about me, but about China. And it's fair to say that there may be no Marxists left in China. There are still plenty of Georges there. I have, as you may have gathered from these introductory words, just a fascination with, and I could go on for a long time, on themes relating to the history, the long history of economic thought, but that's not what I came to speak about today. Time horizons, as you possibly are aware, have become much shorter in our age. Now, the mail used to come every day, now the emails come in every few seconds, and the Facebook posts possibly even faster than that. And the tweets, my God, the tweets is a continuing stream. So I don't want to talk about the history of thought over a span of centuries, but I will restrict myself to 6 short years, which are the development of ideas about the calamity that we all experienced. Some of you were, no doubt, maybe just beginning high school at the time, when the financial crisis struck and some of the major structures of our economy fell to pieces in 2007 to 2009. If you take 2008 as the climactic moment of the great financial crisis, 6 years have gone by. And 6 years is just enough time in the publishing world for pretty much a complete span of work, of books, to emerge reflecting on the topic. And there's now quite a substantial shelf of them. I cannot pretend to have read them all, but I have read a fairly large number. And I've written a book of my own, which is, in some sense, a summary of this literature. There are basically 4 different kinds of work that have appeared. One of them is personal memoirs. And you have the stories, in some cases, quite well-told stories by a Treasury Secretary in the Bush administration, Henry Paulson, by the chair of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, Sheila Bair. Truly a distinguished public servant, by another distinguished public servant, Neil Barofsky, who's the Special Investigator General of the Troubled Asset Relief Program. And there's some others that have come into print in this period. You have a vast number of pages of official investigations. The Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission's report, which was chaired by my actually Harvard classmate, Phil Angelides. The work of the Senate Committee on Permanent Committee on Investigations, chaired by Senator Carl Levin. And many, many reports of what was called the Congressional Oversight Panel, nicely named group COP, for the Troubled Asset Relief Program, which was chaired by Elizabeth Warren, who then went on, as we know, to the Senate seat for Massachusetts. You have accounts by journalists, some of them very lively accounts, Bethany McLean and Joseph Nocera, Fortune and the New York Times, a book called All the Devils Are Here. Matt Taibbi, he of the story of the vampire squid, has his book Griftopia, all of these, many others that are, I think, well worth reading for the vivid account they give of the events as they unfolded. And then you have the academic volumes, interpretations. And the academic interpretations are very numerous. They have a special function. They are not there to relate the facts or to establish who broke the law or to press the Justice Department into coming alive out of its zombie-like trance in which it seems has been stuck for many years. They are there to provide a kind of framework for thinking about these issues, a conceptual overview. And there are quite a lot of them. And I want to try to characterize at least some of this work, because it seems to me to have the very interesting property, for the most part, that academics approaching this work have tried to simplify the problem and to give it, treat the, this crisis, this dramatic financial and economic event, which has had and continuing repercussions for us all, as instances of a theme, generally speaking, a single idea. And it's not hard to, in some way, summarize what that idea is in the different cases. We have, for example, Nassim Taleb, who advanced the idea of, and the metaphorical notion of the black swan. What is a black swan? A black swan is a very rare event. There was a normal distribution on the board when I came up. Sorry, it got taken down, but it illustrated the concept here that sometimes, but only very rarely, extreme things happen. Most swans are white, but then there was a 19th century view that you couldn't have a black swan, and they discovered some in Australia. Okay, so now we know that black swans happen. If the financial crisis was a black swan, it is consistent with the idea that it could not have been predicted, because rare events are extremely rare, but they are not out of the framework that one should, generally speaking, have in mind. There's a variation on that theme, which is considerably bleaker, grimmer, has a darker connotation, and that is the notion that bad events are drawn from probability distributions, but not normal distributions, rather distributions which have what are called fat tails. And the idea of the fat tail is that bad things happen, and they happen with astonishing frequency, very much more often than you would expect from reading a table of probability statistics. There is a foundation for that belief in work on how financial markets behave. If you look at the distribution of changes in all kinds of asset prices, the tails do look depressingly fat, meaning that serious catastrophes, which should only happen once in a billion years, can turn up every 18 months or so, and once again, you can't predict them. Once again, no one can foresee any particular event, and whether you're going to get a boom or a bust is sort of unknowable. All you know is that the system is intrinsically unstable, and it's likely to fall down about your ears, so you better get down into your bomb shelter and close the door. There's another metaphor, which I don't think has been articulated as the kind of explanation of the crisis in any elaborate way, but which has permeated our thinking about it. It has a little bit more structure than these two probability-based arguments. And that is the notion of the bubble. And I think all of us have heard the crisis described as a bubble. But have we spent any time thinking about what that means? What is a bubble? A bubble is, you know, something which expands gradually and pops quickly. It is a metaphor of a physical process, if you like. It's a very vivid metaphor. It conveys a lot of information. If bubbles develop, then popping is inevitable. You can't lance a bubble and let it deflate gently. It doesn't happen. And there's also the idea that, well, maybe bubbles aren't all that harmful. After all, children play with them. Right? And when a bubble is not a bomb, it's not an artillery shell, it doesn't leave a crater. It simply returns things to where they were or would have been without the bubble. Well, so maybe it's not so bad. Alan Greenspan, I think, took the view, just taking this metaphor, to mix a metaphor, by the horns, that one should only just let the bubble happen and clean up afterwards. And that was the Greenspan doctrine. So you can see the power of this particular substitute for thought. And then there are lines of argument which have considerably more structure to them. And I will only mention two of them, maybe three. One of them is that the government caused the crisis. This is a view that was articulated, I think, with great clarity by the minority, the Republican members of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, particularly by Mr. Peter Wallison, who held that, well, what happened was that the government got into the business of encouraging people to buy homes and incentivizing banks to make them loans to do that, and so you got a lot of loans to people who could never pay. And you go back through the Community Reinvestment Act and the various statements of the Housing and Urban Development Agency, and you can find support that this was, in fact, the government's objective. And that is a theoretically clear idea. The idea is that the market would not have led to disaster on its own, that markets are stable, but if the government gets in the way, it has the possibility of destabilizing the market. And you can believe that or not, but you can't, I think, say that it's a per se incoherent vision. I think it's actually a very clear-cut vision. It has a lot of virtue as such. That's a conservative view, certainly. And there is a view which one might characterize as a left-wing view or might characterize as a realistic view, which holds that the crisis was caused by fraud, by criminal activity. That's a proposition for which there is a lot of evidence, and that fraud was incentivized by government, or the conditions for it were facilitated by government, is very clear in that evidence. That there was an enormous amount of such fraud is very clear. I particularly like the story of the mortgage origination firm AmeriQuest. I don't know if you ever heard of it. AmeriQuest was one of the most aggressive firms selling mortgages to people who couldn't pay for them, who could never pay them. According to Nocera and McLean, it greeted its new employees with a welcome to work gift that consisted of a Ziploc bag with scissors, paste, and whiteout for cleaning up loan documents. And in order, these were basically people cold calling poor people to get them to take money. In order to improve their performance as loan officers, that's the right word, AmeriQuest also provided its employees with a ration of crystal methamphetamine. I once asked Neil Borofsky, I was on a panel with him, whether as a former prosecutor he would regard that as a sign of a business with, of an enterprise with an honest business model, he said that as a former prosecutor, he was somewhat skeptical. I'm going to argue, though, that although even that explanation, for which I have a great deal of sympathy because I think it's factually based, is not a sufficient theory of or explanation of what happened. And that if we want to think about the situation we're in, it's not enough to say that if the laws had been better enforced, the crisis would never have occurred. What all of these stories have in common is, I think, the shared view that either the crisis will end on its own, that things will return to their central tendency, or that it can be made to end by getting rid of the bad policy. On the conservative side, got the government out of housing. On the liberal side, replaced the attorney general with a living person. We will be back in business soon enough. And I want to raise, the question I want to raise with you is whether we should be challenging and questioning that view. There are official forecasts which, in which this particular view is deeply embedded. They're based on some ideas which, if you've taken an economics course, you've probably run into. One of them is the natural rate of unemployment. The idea that the economy has a labor market which adjusts so that eventually people go back to work. And that's built into the way the government does forecasting by having 5-year track back to 5% unemployment or whatever the number that they happen to choose. 4.7 for some reason, I think it was. In 2009. 5 years from now, no matter what, we would be back there. Another idea, with a different origin but a similar effect, is the notion of a GDP gap, which is the notion that when there's a recession, the possibility for output for production continues to grow, and the task of policy is, or of the economy, is to get the actual production back up to that standard, right? And then there is the view taken by people who do forecasting for a living, mostly in the business sector, who just have a habit, because they work for profit-seeking organizations, of believing optimistically, and who can blame them, that in 6 months things will start getting better. Right? I've never seen a business forecaster argue anything else in bad times, and nor could they. If you say, well, we're at the start of the next Great Depression, it's downhill all from there, you know, you're out of a job tomorrow. It's not that the business is gone at that point, so we're not going to keep an economist around who's going to tell that, even if they think that he's a pretty good economist, or she is. When you then think about the problem of a government forecaster, you have to recognize they've got this climate of business forecasts in which they're working. And so anybody who, like me, comes into 2009 with our hair on fire and saying, this is the worst thing you've ever seen and it's never going to get better, is either going to be treated as a kook, or averaged in, maybe not treated as a kook, but averaged in with a lot of other people who have a more optimistic view, in which case, just an outlier. Statistically, an outlier is a statistical term for kook, right? Basically the same thing. In any event, it's practically impossible for a view like that to get traction in economics. There's no way of testing it, and so your credibility depends on how close your thinking is to everybody else's. Only in hindsight can you begin to present the evidence and be one of these annoying people who says always, I told you so. Right? But after 5 or 6 years, I'm finally ready to publish the book, which I could have titled, I Told You So. I figured it would be too annoying. 2009, I did write an article called No Return to Normal. The book is going to be called The End of Normal. But there are just a number of things, which, and I won't go over a whole long list, but a short list that seem to me to be sufficient to make the case. The first is employment in the relation to population, which is right along at the bottom of where it was. Yes, the unemployment rate has come down, but not because jobs have been restored. Unemployment has come down because people have stopped looking for work. Right? That's very clear. And so the ratio of employment to population is still 8 points, maybe 10 million people below where it was 15 years ago. Secondly, the housing sector. You can count the cranes. They're not there. So you get reports that the housing sector has gone up compared to where it was a year ago. It's at an abysmally low level compared to where it was in the good years. Thirdly, to the extent that there is progress, we can see in the recent data that it has been slowing down. Maybe some of that was bad winter weather, but there's a fair amount of persistent evidence and reason to believe that each bit of good news is overstated and each bit of bad news is underrated. And fourth, there's the fact that we're not alone in this, that where we have in fact stabilized, in Europe, large parts of the economy are still going down and have not been effectively stabilized. And that is because major parts of the European Union remain in a deep, unbroken cycle of debt and austerity, contraction and decline, of which the most extreme case is Greece, leading to what I believe is still a deepening political crisis in Europe, the rise of extreme right-wing parties as a consequence of the failure of the European Union to come to grips over many years with its economic and structural problems. Now, I just say that's sufficient to establish for us that things did not go according to plan or according to expectation as of 5 years ago. And so let's ask, why not? Why didn't we get the return to where we were? I think you've got to place this in a larger historical frame and think about the whole period since the Second World War. And I think if you do that, you come to basically three significant phases with turning points. First one is a period in which the whole world was growing, 1945 to 1970. There was a stable international order. Poor countries grew a little bit more rapidly than rich countries, so there was convergence. But basically, shared economic expansion. That all got badly beaten up in the 1970s. As a result of changing resource prices, changing origin of much of American energy from being in Texas to being in the Middle East, and a whole redistribution of global power and control, which severely threatened at that time the standing of the United States at the top of the global pecking order. And then that standing was restored from 1980 to 2000 or so. And it was restored by a sequence of policies running from Reagan to Clinton. High interest rates, which put much of the third world into deep crisis. Big budget deficits, which produced economic growth here, but which could not have been followed in other countries. Consequence of that period was that whereas we began to think of the whole half century from 1945 until 1995 or 2000, more than half a century, as one long phase of economic growth interrupted by a little trouble, the rest of the world had a very different view. The rest of the world sees the period after 1980 as being one of deep problems. Whether you're in Brazil, or you're in South Asia, or certainly if you're in Africa, and even in parts of Europe. And the result of that, which shows up in my work on inequality, is that the inequality between the rich and the poor, and between rich and poor countries, goes up enormously in those 20 years. Enormously. Starting with the Reagan high interest rates and ending with the Clinton information technology, which brought money in from financially unstable places. So we got the impression, reinforced, that we were in a kind of permanent structure of economic growth. The future would be just like the past. The rest of the world was much wiser about these matters. And in 2000, the illusions start to crumble. It's the last end of the last big business expansion, the big credit expansion based on business. And I would put the start of our present troubles there and not in 2007. Why? Because it seems to me that my fellow Texan, George W. Bush, and I hate to say anything sympathetic about his presidency, but he faced a very tough situation into which he threw a number of expedients that masked it. Number one, tax cuts. Number two, wars. Number three, all kinds of public spending in 2003, 2004. Number four, above all, mortgages. That is to say, a de-supervision of the financial sector, which had previously been deregulated, so that the businesses, particularly private label mortgage originators, got the correct idea they could do anything they wanted, issuing all kinds of loans, which they knew very well would either have to be renegotiated or would default in 3 years. 327s, 228s, loans with exploding payments, loans that were tied to various corrupt indexes, loans that were at the limit of the capacity of borrowers whose incomes were basically concealed, or lack of income was concealed, and on houses that were fraudulently overappraised, so that loans could be made that were more than the houses were worth, something no honest business would ever do. And the only way to make money off of that is you book a fee when the loan is made, and you book another one when it's sold to some innocent investor, who in this case was typically German. Many other types as well, but there's a nice phrase and a little exchange in Michael Lewis's great book, The Big Short, in which one banker is asking another, who's buying this stuff anyway? And the answer comes back, Dusseldorf. And that was the way the business worked. You can think about it as, there's some terms you may be familiar with. The mortgages themselves looked like mortgages, but they weren't mortgages. They were counterfeits. The ratings agencies were labeled ratings agencies, but they weren't ratings agencies. They were in the business of laundering. The commercial and investment banks looked like commercial and investment banks, but they were actually in the business of fencing. And the ultimate buyer was we call them a mark. Somebody who was going to take the loss eventually, which they did when the whole system collapsed in 2007 to 2009. So where are we now? I think what we have experienced since then is an increasing understanding that we are faced with major problems going forward. Problems which are not, it's not sufficient to say that if we had a better view of matters, more psychological confidence, we would all be better off, we would all recover. Not sufficient to say that the instruments of fiscal policy or monetary policy can get us back to where we were. And I would just want to point to, again, four things that seem to me bear on this. One of them perhaps a little bit tenuously, but I think it has a role in the background. First one is resource costs. What caused us trouble in the 1970s was a rise in the price of oil. Price of oil went up to $148 in the summer of 2008 per barrel, and that was a factor in precipitating the crisis here and globally. Now, the price collapsed, as it would do. But what we are seeing is not just a question about the supply of that commodity, but also about the financialization of it. When the price starts rising, investors start putting their money into it in order to hold the stuff off the market, and the price gets higher. And you get a cycle in these prices, which is very destabilizing. When the price is going up, that's not good for energy users. When it's going down, it's not good for renewables and other sources. On the resource front, shale gas, as anybody in Texas can tell you, is a new phenomenon which may change this. And that I can't say. Right now it looks very promising, but what we don't know is how long it will last. Gas wells are like champagne bottles. They fizz for a while and then they go. But this is a new technology, we just don't know. Nobody knows. You have to wait until the gas wells are in production to discover when they lose pressure. Second thing is something I think we've learned in the 2000s that is changing the way the world thinks about the United States, and that has to do with military power. In 2000, it was possible to believe that the U.S. was a lone hyperpower. All kinds of phrases were thrown around. Now we know we've tried it in Iraq, we've tried it in Afghanistan, we haven't accomplished very much. And the military will be the first to tell you that they do not have the kind of focus on that or authority over the world that political leaders 15 years ago claimed they had. I think that's an important factor. Just the one that's the one I would keep in the background. The third one is technologies. These things. There's a debate about this in economics, about whether new technologies are costing jobs. And I take the position, contrary to many other of my fellow progressives, that they do. Because it seems to me self-evidently the case that when businesses are forced to downsize in the wake of a big slump, it's not that they downsize because new technologies are invented, but when they downsize and then they're thinking about coming back, they make choices. And they make choices in favor of cheap, untaxed machinery over expensive and heavily taxed labor, labor on which they have to pay payroll taxes and health insurance and other costs, which these things, by and large, don't require. And I think that is going to be a factor that we will increasingly see in the future. I have a little example, just one. I mean, everybody has them. You can go into a drugstore and discover that you don't have a checkout person there anymore, a grocery store. Or you come into the United States and you discover that you're not greeted by an immigration officer anymore. You flash your passport at a machine. But my favorite one is from a friend who's an economist for Federal Express, who points out to me that smartphones are hurting their air freight business from Asia. Now, why would that be? What's the most obvious fact about a smartphone? How many of you have them? What's the most single most obvious, inescapable fact about these things? Yes? They're small. They're small. You can put an awful lot of them on a single airplane. And they're replacing a lot of other things which were previously flown over in their other airplanes. So there are a lot of pilots and aircraft that Federal Express can't use because it can get out. I mean, it's a social saving, but it's not great for the airplane companies or the pilots. And we're going to see that just in every aspect of what we do. And the fourth thing, which stems, I think, is where the story of financial fraud and the collapse of integrity of the system comes to play, is that the financial sector has not been reformed, has not been reduced in size. It's a vast deadweight cost on all other forms of business. That is to say, banks may get money from the Federal Reserve at zero, but if you're a small business, you aren't getting money from your bank at zero. And you have to pay the support of the bank, which dominates every street corner in this town, as anybody can see. There are vastly too many of them. They support vastly too many people at too high a price, much more than any other country you can think of, I think. And the result of that is that they are, and they're not doing anything. They're not doing anything. It's been 15 years since they financed a business boom, and 7 years since they finished financing the greatest and most destructive epidemic of mortgage fraud in history. What are they good for? What do they do except provide ways for rich clients to evade taxes and regulations and check clearing services that could be done by the post office? Much less, I ask. I think until we deal with those problems, we are at best going to be stabilized, and we might not even get that far. So, I'm taking my time, what are the implications? Very simple. First of all, I think it is reasonable not to expect to disabuse ourselves of the notion that the last 50 years were the normal to which we have an inevitable tendency to return. Start thinking freshly about how you behave when that isn't the case. Secondly, the implication I draw from that is that we should be relying even more than we have on the institutions which have proven most effective in protecting people on these conditions, which are our social insurance institutions created in the New Deal, primarily. Social Security, unemployment insurance, minimum wages, which are far too low, deposit insurance, and healthcare insurance, which came in with the Great Society and is still being worked on. All of these things play the role, particularly when times are tough, of giving people a more secure foundation. Roosevelt knew this in 1935 when Social Security was enacted. The Depression was still underway. He didn't wait for there to be a boom for this to do this. He understood that this would help support people and allow them to become more in control of their destiny than they otherwise would. Thirdly, reduce the overheads and the fixed costs, and I've mentioned two of them, the financial sector and the military, which, both of which, it seems to me, we have extremely serious questions about whether they will be, in any near or reasonable future, useful in their present form. Fourth, and finally, to the extent that we can buy ourselves some breathing room by taking steps that give us a little more security and a little less deadweight cost, focus on the long-term problems, of which there are many. Caring for an elderly population, building up the infrastructure, climate change, especially climate change. That is the long run of the long run. And if we don't deal with it now, it will be beyond the capacity of our children and grandchildren to deal with it. So we ought to be putting some resources, much more resources into that than we have. And then, very finally, my father taught me years ago that at the end, toward two-thirds of the way through your speech, one should say, finally, because that wakes up your audience, gives them hope. But I really am at the end. I mean, finally. I think you can just hope that I'm wrong and that we get a lucky break. Thanks very much.